Welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoy the program. And that, dear listener, gives us some indication of the content of the next hour. As we go back beyond the grand narratives of Handel to when Christianity was a struggling religion in the midst of the turbulence of the late Roman Empire, particularly the time of Constantine. Within just a few years of Constantine declaring the Christian faith, the standard by which the Roman Empire would be measured, Rome itself fell. What are we to make of that? Well, our guests, Hal Drake and Sean Frayne, have participated in a conference last week in Melbourne discussing religion and politics in the early church, and they're our guests this evening. And this is a favourite selection of Sean Frayne. Religion and the politics of the early church, a fascinating arena where Christianity met the empire and, according to some, changed for the worst forever. Our guests are Research Professor of History at the University of California, Santa Barbara, Hal Drake. Hal, welcome to you.
Thank you.
And retired Professor of Theology at Trinity College at the University of Dublin, Sean Frayne. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Now, you're both at a conference in Melbourne sponsored by the Australian Catholic University on politics and the early church. It's an area of continued fascination, this intersection between a new religion and the politics of an empire. Hal, what's the nature of this fascination? Why do you think people are eternally fascinated by moments like this?
I'll try to give you a brief answer. But there's a lot of European history involved. And a lot of the way we think about this question and the way we discuss this question has to do with thinkers in the 18th century, the Enlightenment, who viewed the Christian church as opposed to free thought, opposed to progress, and also the cause of a horrible century of wars. And so they framed a narrative of Roman history that put Christianity in opposition to classical Roman. For English speakers, Edward Gibbon is the classic work. And when he came to explaining the success of Christianity, he had a famous five reasons, the first of which was intolerance, Christian intolerance. So the narrative is that the classical civilization, classical reason, all of the great products of antiquity came to a crashing end with the conversion of Constantine to Christianity when Gibbon referred to the fall of the Roman Empire as due to the rise of superstition and barbarism. And I think that's Sean might disagree with me, but I think that's the paradigm that's been followed for two and a half centuries since the 18th century, when people look at the question of the fall of Rome, that everything was going great.
Until the Christians came along.
Right.
Sean, there's an alternate Christian narrative that's been popular in churches in recent years as well, and that is Christianity was doing very, very well, thank you, until it got incorporated into the politics of the state. And since then, it's all been downhill.
Indeed. Yes, the great sin of the church was the Constantinian settlement, if you like, where Christianity and the empire suddenly joined hands, whereas previously Christianity was this persecuted little sect within the Mediterranean region generally. And so the Christians who like to think of their Christian church today as being some way opposed to the the political world, I think, tend to like that narrative and propagate it as a way of suggesting that early Christianity should always be in opposition to imperial structures or political structures generally that are not either dominated by religion, by the religion, or in opposition to it. So I think that that story needs to be revised as well. I think we've seen now that early Christianity, from a very early stage, had to find ways of accommodating itself to imperial structures, and did so fairly well with certain moments when, of course, the persecution broke out, beginning, of course, with Nero's persecution, I think, in the first century, and thereafter several other ones over the next number of centuries. But it is a story, as I say, that needs to be revised, I think, somehow.
Yes, it sort of reminds one of the "what have the Romans ever done for us" moment in Monty Python.
Yeah,
that's right.
Let's look at this for the moment, because Constantine was significant not just for his actions in bringing Christianity into the empire, but actually in taking hold of Christianity and giving it, forcing it to adopt certain principles which have governed church thinking ever since. He actually got engaged in the business of forcing a theological framework on the church, the Great Council of Nicaea.
Yeah, I wouldn't give him as much of agency as has become popular to do. He was certainly instrumental in calling the conference and in trying to reconcile the parties. And I personally, because I study the subject from a political rather than a religious point of view, I'm fascinated by the way he was an extraordinary politician, and he took a very damaged religion that had just gone through a horrible 10-year persecution prior to Constantine, and coaxed these leaders into cooperating with the state. I think the important question that lies underneath that gets missing is, it's almost impossible for us now to think of church and state as anything except two separate systems. Constantine, therefore, fits under state, and therefore anything he did with regard to religion is a sort of an intrusion. In the 19th century, the word Caesaropapism was developed to indicate a situation in which the Caesar, the emperor, acted like a pope, dictating in religion where he had no grounds to be. And although it's speaking broadly, I've always tried to get my students to understand that the ancient state, as far as we're concerned, was itself a religious institution, in the sense that the first duty of the leaders of any ancient state you've ever heard or read about was to maintain good relations with divinity. And I use divinity rather than God or the gods, because there's a continuity there. When Christianity came in, it didn't introduce this idea. It really followed it, because it's simply not clear that at that time they had the conceptual categories to think of church and state as anything different. The emperor was Pontifex Maximus, head of the Roman state religion. To the extent that the intervention of deity determined who was going to win a battle or whether there was going to be a successful harvest, it was mandatory. It was incumbent upon the emperor as the head of that apparatus to ensure that the empire was going to be run in accordance with what divinity wanted. I don't know if that's making sense.
So in a sense, yes, Christianity is taken up into the existing order, because it couldn't be otherwise once Constantine had made that decision. I guess the other question then, Sean, that applies is, in acting the way he did with regard to the church, do we give Constantine credit? What is he to be the subject of some critique? Is there some genuine critique in the observation that the Constantinian settlement did ultimately damage and reshape Christianity in quite profound way that meant that Christianity became something else?
Well, certainly my argument would be, of course, that with the emergence of the Constantinian settlement, there's a gradual, the theologians, if you like, people like Eusebius of Caesarea, for example, who wrote A Life of Constantine, already begins to kind of deify, in a way, this rule of Constantine. He's almost another example of the word incarnate that John's Gospel had applied to Jesus already. So there's that kind of trend, and theological trend to begin with, so that now the emperor takes on religious significance within the Christian denomination or Christian church. And at the same time, of course, it led then to gradually, eventually over the centuries, this further church taking control of the empire and adopting imperial ways in many, many respects. Even today, I often say to my students, you know, if you want to really understand a little bit of what Roman imperial life was like, just look at the Vatican. You have the whole idea of the household, the papal household, the papal guard, and so on and so on. So there are a number of institutions that we can see in the Vatican today that indeed replicate or are the continuation of ones that already were part of the imperial structures in Rome. So I think that in that sense, clearly, the memory of the Jesus of Galilee who was put to death as a criminal for challenging Roman power is certainly kind of something of an embarrassment, and is gradually forgotten in terms of Christian spirituality, I think. And part of the task, I think, today is to recover something of that cutting edge, if you will, of the Jesus story that challenges some of that easy synthesis between church and state that has developed out of the Constantinian settlement.
We're talking about religion and politics in the early church, Constantine, the Roman Empire, and all that. This notion that Jesus' teaching had implicit in it a political message which was reshaped and in some ways suppressed by the adoption of Roman Christianity. This particularly located in what's called Jesus' kingdom theology, the whole idea of his nature of the relationship between humanity and the world, the created order.
Yes, I think, of course, Jesus was heir to a tradition of understanding God as king from within his own Jewish religious heritage. And it had emerged, I think, more and more in the centuries prior to Christianity as an important way of thinking about a possibility of a Jewish state that would emerge independently of different imperial structures. We had the Persian, the Neo-Babylonian, the Persian and the Greek empires before that. And within that context, Jewish theology emerged, where the notion of God's kingly rule would be established in opposition to the earthly rules. I think the book of Daniel in the Hebrew Bible is a good example of where that theology, if you like, to which we apply the term apocalyptic sometimes, begins to really to be developed. The different kingdoms of the earth can be identified in the various beasts that appear in the book of Daniel, but eventually they are going to be overthrown and a new kingdom will emerge, the kingdom of the saints of the Most High. So it becomes a kind of story and an expectation of eventually where the Jewish tradition will again be no longer enslaved, if you will, to other imperial powers that have dominated the Middle East before that. So it's in that, out of that background, if you will, that the notion of the kingdom of God becomes central to Jesus' own proclamation and his own ministry. His ministry really becomes a ministry of dealing with the victims of imperial rule, in this case now Roman rule, and particularly as displayed by the Herodian house as the Roman rulers, client kings in Judea. And so I think within that context, Jesus comes into Galilee just at a moment when the very signs of imperial rule were beginning to be imposed in the landscape itself, in buildings and structures and so on.
But he shifts the groundwork, doesn't he? Because he says, my kingdom is not of this world. So there's a shift slightly in the paradigm here.
Well, yes, that's one quotation, but there are many quotations that says the kingdom is here now and it has taken you all by surprise.
And this is what people are wrestling with still today, is it not? It's why the question is relevant.
That's right, absolutely. Yeah, I think that in a way, sometimes I think Christian theologians in particular have this problem about deciding, did Jesus talk about a future kingdom that was going to come or a present kingdom now or whatever? I think that, again, going back to what Hal had been saying earlier about the Roman imperial viewpoint, the idea that God was caring for his world all the time, it wasn't a matter of now or the future. He's always caring. He's the Melech Olam. He's the king of the ages. And so the idea of present future that we have difficulty with, I think, in our modern interpretation, doesn't seem to arise in quite the same way for the early Christians.
Well, one of the things that people point to when they're talking about this is the fact that the early Christians show an indication of being pacifists, of being communitarian, that along comes the Constantinian settlement, and all of a sudden Christians find that the army is a completely proper place to in which to serve, so that there was a political as well as an internal or sort of spiritual transfer modification went on here.
Yes. Hal, do you want to...
Well, I would just point out there's abundant evidence that Christians were serving in the Roman army before Constantine.
Mm. Right.
And I can cite some of that. But what strikes me as I was thinking as Sean spoke, I come from a slightly different perspective, probably because I'm from Southern California. So I'm sensitive to the impact Hollywood has had on the general understanding of the relationship between Christianity and Rome. And one of those has to do with the idea that Rome opposed Christians because they were these new saintly moral beings who were getting in the way of their fun. And nothing could be farther from the truth. The problem that the earliest Christians had was that from the Roman perspective, they were considered to be an immoral people. But the other thing that Hollywood has done is sort of crunched the timeline so that usually there's Nero because he's absolutely fun to have in a movie. And then he's overthrown, and then the Christians take over rule. So 3 centuries in which Christians and Romans lived together, sometimes in short bursts of persecution, but in a lot of times in dialogue with each other, gets ignored. And that's the part that concerns me. There are these different impulses in Christianity, and one that I've broadly associated with that of the Christian apologists, people who weren't going around saying, I'm sorry, I'm Christian, but that's the Greek legal term. An apologist an apologia is a defense. So these were the defenders of Christianity, and they tried to do it the way a good teacher will do things, by finding things in the worldview of the people they're talking to that they can relate to with Christianity. And so they start adopting particularly philosophical terminology to help explain why Christianity wasn't so strange. The part that we're taught to believe that Romans couldn't accept was the idea of a divine being taking mortal form. That was the easiest thing for people in the ancient world to accept, because it happened all the time. The difficulty was that Christians were claiming the supreme God, which at least since the time of Plato, at least intellectual pagans understood, the supreme God had undergone the degradation and defilement that went along with human existence. And that's what Christians had to prove. And they used the Roman emperor as an example of how one person sitting in the center can be governing everything through emissaries and legates in order to explain their monotheistic beliefs. One very strong early Christian tradition, at least from the second century, was the argument that the Roman Empire was part of God's plan, because if you're not a stickler for chronology, Augustus, the first Roman emperor, and Jesus, the founder of Christianity, appear in the world at roughly the same time. And the argument is that Christianity and the Roman Empire were always meant to reconcile and be part of each other. So what happens under Constantine with Eusebius, as Sean was talking about, is Eusebius very much believes this. And he says, now the problem has been reconciled, and God's will is being fulfilled.
There's a sense in which you're reminding us that everybody who wrote an account was writing it for a purpose.
Yeah.
That ancient historians and writers like Eusebius are making a point, that theologians like Origen and others are making points. They are actually trying to defend a position or argue for a position in a particular political context, and that in a sense, Christianity, rather than being captured and changed, was as much part of the change as the empire was, that this is not the imposition, it's an evolution of both parties.
Exactly, exactly. There's a great Italian scholar who spent most of his career at Oxford, Arnaldo Momigliano, and at one point he said, every Christian, no matter what else he was always a little bit of an apologist. So your point is exactly right.
Sean, there's another interesting point here too that leads out of this, and this is the going back to the notion of what have the Romans ever done for us. Mm. That is, if Christianity hadn't accommodated itself and been accommodated by the empire, one could argue whether in fact Christianity would ever have become a civilizational religion in quite the way it did and have shaped the West as profoundly as it did.
Oh, undoubtedly that is the case, I think. And of course, it's only when we begin to kind of look at the way Christianity might possibly evolve in other contexts, newer, fresher contexts, that is not imported, if you like, from the West, say, for example, in Africa or perhaps in Asia, that we might begin to see the differences that are possible. And that is, I think, one of the realities of early Christian thinking, that they've shown us the way to this key buzzword that's often used, inculturation, that Hal has been talking about. In other words, adopting the language, the style, the images, the symbols of a particular culture, and as we're applying these to the particular beliefs and practices that the early Christians would be recognized as genuinely remembering the memory of Jesus.
And you then capture the vitality of that culture and add it to your own vitality.
That's right. That's right. And I think in particular, of course, one of the great things was, and one of the things that amazes me when I look at early Christianity and the spread of it, the diversity within it. I think, again, we talk about Christianity so as a kind of a single a seamless garment, so to speak. But just even to think already of the number of different translations of the gospel stories that we get in different languages, different local ethnic languages that we can document, Syriac, Coptic, Ethiopic, and so on. So that even though Greek and Latin were the language, if you like, of the lingua franca of the empire, yet somehow or other this Christian movement was somehow or other addressing another layer within the society. Eventually, of course, it was going to also be acceptable and highly acceptable to the aristocrats of the empire, and that's why, of course, Constantine wanted to adopt it as perhaps the best way of bringing together East and West within his imperial structure. But I think that we see a dynamic, if you like, or a dynamism within the early Christian story that is able to do this precisely because Jesus himself had done it. He had taken the images of the everyday life of his own particular context and used those to speak about God's presence in the world today, his parables, his use of proverbs and so on, using the very language of the ordinary people. So I think that is part of the dynamism, if you will, that Christianity at its best is able to shed, if it can shed itself today, of some of the outmoded structures that it is, that, you know, may have served it well in the past, then I think it's beginning to take up again the challenge of the gospel, it seems to me.
I'd like to come to that present condition in a moment, but just one question before we move on about Jesus himself. This is a much argument in scholarship about Jesus and his context. He's in northern Galilee. He's a Galilean. This is the area in which he preaches, is around Caesarea and other places. Is it reasonable to think that Jesus would have spoken Greek?
Possibly. But I think the more likely thing, Jesus' ministry, I think, was more to the village people. He may have known some Greek, and that wouldn't be, he travelled around, and we're not to see him as a kind of the ignorant, boorish peasant. He had, after all, left his hometown Nazareth, where he should have been bringing up a family, if he's being a good Jewish boy, and looking after the land and so on. He headed down to the Jordan Valley, where he encountered John the Baptist, this dissident Jerusalem priest, son of a priest. And so we have to see that Jesus himself is already searching for something different to what his own religious tradition and his own particular context was offering. So he comes back to Galilee not as a kind of a homecoming, but rather as a prophet with a message, a different message about what is demanded now. And it was to do, I think, very much with looking at the I would argue, the social conditions he encounters, particularly the way in which Roman imperial structures were beginning to kind of bite and beginning to make inroads onto the lives of people. So you can see a gradual sort of slippage from small peasant landowner, which was the Jewish ideal that everybody would share a plot of land in the land of Israel, this land that was gifted to them by God, to people, day laborers, brigandage, and so on. So we see the beginnings of a breakdown of the social structures, if you will, and it's in that context, I think, that a lot of Jesus' own message and deeds are to be understood, I think, in that particular context. And so it does point us, I think, to an understanding of a message for the poor, and that Jesus, as liberation theology has taught us today, this preferential option for the poor, that somehow there should be no poor in Israel, because Israel, the gift of the land has been given to all Israel, not to some people. And Rome's presence has only complicated that process, because we have big landowners and so on beginning to emerge. Building materials, Herodian building projects, which we admire so greatly today, of course, they were done by labor, forced labor sometimes, and of course, they demanded more taxation and so on. So I think it's within that, as were, concrete context of two kingdoms, if you like, a kingdom of God that was about sharing and caring for everybody and all God's creatures and his whole creation, and a kingdom that was very much based on imperial rule and imposing, if you like, its will on others. The Pax Romana was imposed from above rather than something that was achieved by conversion of the heart or so on, or love of enemy, which Jesus is unique, it seems to me, in the ancient world.
So there's a sense in which the Roman Empire is the necessary catalyst for the development of this new teaching out of Judaism, that in some ways it's the spur, or it can be seen as a critical spur for Jesus' insights.
I think that's true. I think that other branches of Judaism, and I think I want to see early Christianity initially as another branch within a dissident form, if you like, of Judaism, but one that carries on its tradition very clearly. I think other branches perhaps had taken different options. We had, for example, the monks in Qumran, went to the desert, as it were, replicating the origins of Israel in the desert. Others adopted the militaristic approach, and eventually leading to the first revolt against Rome in 70 AD, or 66 AD to 70, which led to the destruction of the temple in 70. So there were many different options, if you like, and there was a certain fragmentation of Judean society in this period, and the Jesus movement comes out of that fissure, if you will, and I think it is this ability to adapt that made it one that was able to kind of eventually, with Paul and others, will move from the villages of Galilee to the urban context of the Roman Empire, and there again begin to do the same kind of thing, taking over some of the institutions of the city and applying them now to the early Christian movement as this will develop and go forward.
There's one other observation, Hal Drake, I'd like to make before we move to some present considerations, and this is to do with the transition of Christianity and its relationship to the empire, and it's a little later on, that is, as the empire breaks into the empire of the East and the empire of the West, so Christianity is again reshaped into the Orthodox tradition and the Roman tradition, and it seems that the ancient imperial Roman structures were more preserved in the Western Church, and let me advance an argument to say that if hadn't been for that, much of what we understand to be contemporary Western civilization would not have come to be.
Yeah, that's one of the paradoxes of setting Christianity in opposition to Rome, that after the civil structure in the West deteriorates and eventually collapses, it's this shadow administration, in a way that Sean had mentioned, it's the Bishop of Rome who takes up the title of Pontifex Maximus, for instance, and clergy throughout the West who had simply, because they're educated, assume a lot of the functions that used to be performed by the Roman Empire, they wind up being the transmitters of classical civilization. It comes through Christianity. I think that in order to resolve this paradox, you have to see Christians and Romans developing in a similar cultural context. so that they weren't entirely in opposition with each other. What happens in the West, from the standpoint of Western European historical development, it's always the West is always regarded as the truest heir of Rome, and it was these terrible Byzantines, whoever they are, and these terrible Muslims who took the rest of the empire away. But you could really argue that most of Rome and the way Rome thought and believed survived in the East and in the South, and it was the West that where the most radical break occurred, because the Roman Empire collapsed, and it was really because of that the Christian administration moved in to fill a vacuum. Does that make sense?
Yes, and ultimately, of course, Sean is going to claim the credit for those Irish monks sort of moving back down the rivers of Europe and re-establishing civilization.
Indeed, yes, saving it, yes.
You're on Sunday night on ABC Radio. Our guests are the Research Professor of History at the University of California, Santa Barbara, Hal Drake, and the retired Professor of Theology at the Trinity College at the University of Dublin, Sean Frame. We're talking about early Christianity and politics and Christianity in the early church. Gentlemen, let's turn to present considerations, because both of you are saying that, look, the experience of the early church, what we understand about the relationship between the civil and religious authorities of that early Christian period still contains relevance for us today. Sean, we've already alluded to some of the material that you're interested in, and that's the nature of arguing about what the kingdom of God was and meant and who Jesus was meant to serve and the way this has been sort of interpreted over the years. But for just a moment, Hal, I'd like to talk to some of your concerns. One of the papers that you've delivered to this current conference is called The Curious Case of George and the Camel. And you illustrate it, you use it as an illustration to say how some sort of political issues resonate even to today. And in this particular illustration, it's the whole issue of martyrdom. And we're familiar, of course, today in the present political context with Islamic martyrs, with people who are going in with bombs and blowing themselves up from Pakistan to Lebanon. But you actually say, look, the politics and the religion here is very similar to from era to era.
Well, yes, I think one of the reasons why I insist on seeing religion and politics as inseparable in the ancient world is simply because if one of the things of all of the sorry events of our own days have taught us is that to simply say that what is happening because the suicide bombers are Muslims can be explained by differences in the religions is simply far too simple and doesn't get at the heart of what's going on. And we've with great pain in the West, come to understand that there are underlying conditions that are more social, cultural, and political by our categories than they are religious. And my argument is the same thing goes on in the ancient world. What I try to say specifically about martyrdom is, of course, martyrs are the great Christian heroes. They're always showed up as the people. Again, it's a word from Greek legal terminology. A martyr is a witness. So the martyrs, what were they witnessing to? By their willingness to endure unspeakable physical pains and death, they were testifying to the truth of Jesus' message. As well, at least their belief in the truth of Jesus' message. And it had such a strong impact that we tend to talk about the martyrs as a form of self-fashioning, just as we often talk about the suicide bombers and the self-fashioning that goes on with their decision to become a martyr. The point I'm trying to make in this paper is that I look at some attempts at martyrdom that failed, and they failed because the broader community did not accept the reasons for the martyrdom. So that I'm trying to show it as a two-way process. There's the candidate for martyrdom and what he or she believes, but there's also the broader community that has got to be convinced that this person is acting in defense of our core values.
So that the underlying social and political context is critically important. That is, if it doesn't resonate with the surrounding community, it's a waste. And those resonances have as much to do with the social and political conditions as they do with any religious precepts.
Exactly. But also, as painful as it is, we in the West have got to realize that there are the people who flew the airplanes into the World Trade Center are celebrated as martyrs by at least people who believe that they did this in defense of the core values of their community. The reason I stress this is because if we aren't sensitive to this, I think we lose the debate before it starts if we just try to delegitimize what they're saying because they did something horrible in our eyes.
Well, it means that we've both got to be sensitive to the political and social conditions in which these situations arise, but also we need to take the religion seriously as religion.
Exactly. Exactly.
And that's what's been left out in so much of the discussion?
I often give my students a pop quiz where they have three choices. I do this to challenge them and make them think about what religion means. But if the second coming occurred today, would Jesus address the United Nations? Would he celebrate in the Sistine Chapel with the world's religious leaders? Or would he drink Muscatel out of a paper bag with winos on Skid Row? And my students rarely choose that third option, which is the one I personally think. The other thing that I do to provoke them is that if they really believe that religious truth is demonstrated by success in this world, they should compare the first 50 years of Christianity with the first 50 years of Islam. And after 50 years of Christianity, it was going nowhere. It was stuck in... Sean will disagree with me on this, but it wasn't giving indications of becoming a world religion. After 50 years, Islam was in rule of the largest empire the world had ever seen. And I do that not to say that it's right, but to challenge people thinking that that religion is supposed to be demonstrated by worldly success.
Sean, well, you'd be sympathetic to the to Jesus, where Jesus was sitting?
Well, indeed, very much so.
With the wino?
I would like to quote exactly what Jesus himself said, that he was, unlike this rather severe mentor he had, John the Baptist, out in the desert, he was rather pilloried as somebody who sat with wine drinkers and gluttons and was having a good time. This is a citation or a paraphrase of something in the Gospels. So I think Jesus was certainly with the underdogs, wherever they might be or whoever they might be in a particular culture.
It does bring us, though, to a major final point. And Sean, you can go first on this, and yes, then Hal, I'll let you wind up. The major final point is just this. Where does Christianity now find its way forward? There is a tension between those who say, look, Christianity has got to find its way by simply going back to its roots, being locally, congregationally based, and ignore politics, stay out of politics. Politics is just the way of the world. There are others who are saying, no, Christianity and Christians can have an important role in being members of political parties, being seen to actually try and reshape the structures and institutions of the world by playing in the world. How?
Well, actually, I'd like to go back to something you said at the outset when you asked about the role of Christianity in the fall of the Roman Empire, and when you turned to Sean and said, now there are Christians who would say the big mistake was reconciling with the state. I thought you were going to say something else, because the popular Christian narrative that shows its way in movies all the time is that the Roman Empire fell because it was so immoral and it was full of these lusty pagans. Whereas I think, as a historian, and I see everything in a historical context, I don't know what date you were taught for the fall of Rome, but the most popular one is the sack of the city in August of 410. And the shocking thing about that was that it came almost exactly 20 years after a Roman emperor officially made Christianity the religion of the Roman Empire. There were lots of people who we call pagans going around saying, look, we were safe and secure under our gods for 1,000 years. Your God comes in, and 20 years later, look what happened. And that provokes the thinking of one of the fundamental texts of Western civilization, which is St. Augustine's City of God, which he tries to separate whatever happens to the earthly state from the religious experience. And that's, I think, what you were raising. But it's also a new way of thinking about the fall of Rome and what it meant, that it was Rome was actually in probably the most moral and puritanical state of its history when it fell for the first time in 800 years to a foreign enemy.
Sure. Indeed, I would like to come back to another aspect of your question, as I heard it, and namely, what does Christianity do now? Where does it find itself? Is it a question of simply going back to the past, or is it a question of facing new challenges today? I think it's fair to say that in the Western world, Christianity is on the decline, seriously on the decline. And many people, I think, find themselves very troubled by this. But I was reading, actually, a very interesting book recently, entitled The Death of Christianities, plural. And St. Vincent de Paul in the 17th century said that God didn't say he was going to be with the church in Europe, for example. So I think we're going to have to look at the church, Christianity more as a worldwide movement, where I think there will be new growth. And one of the new places where growth is certainly occurring would be, for me, the kind of where martyrdom in the modern Christian sense of the word has taken place, namely in Latin America, where people have often been killed as for example in El Salvador, precisely for standing up for the vision of Jesus' care for the poor and the attempt to translate that vision into a social vision for the whole society. And of course, that was far too much for a particular regime to accept. So I think there are, we tend to look far too narrowly to just a Western European version of Christianity that is certainly on the decline for various reasons that we obviously don't have time to talk about now, but we have to think about what are the possibilities. And for me, the possibilities would be to deal with the kind of issues about life and death that are very central to the human existence itself. And there, I think Christianity has still something to offer in terms of establishing communities of caring and sharing that will at a ground level express something of the values of the gospel. Now, where that will go in terms of an institutional organization on top, for me, the church that I belong to, namely Roman Catholicism, works best when it works in a local context. Once I get past that level, I begin to see bureaucracy at its worst taking over. And I see all kinds of political games being played that would do well in any parliament or backbench situation in any of the parliaments that I know of. So I think that there is a moment of purification that has to take place. And I think part of the going back to the message of Jesus is precisely something of that will bring us back to something of the basic message of what Christianity was about and where it eventually was able to present a view of human life that was acceptable and became more and more acceptable to many people in the Roman Empire from the bottom to the top. But I think, for me anyhow, that is where my own work as working with the historical Jesus and understanding his life and times is precisely about the way in which it might lead to some kind of renewal of Christian vision for today.
Sean Frayne, thank you very much for joining us. Hal Drake, thank you also for guiding us through some fascinating history and some insights into contemporary situation. It's been great to have you with us on Sunday night.
It was a pleasure to be here.
Thank you very much.
This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. Thank you for listening.